against Merck. Just advice.
Thank you, Your Honor. I might at some point in time refer to the charts that my associate, Mr. Swick, is putting up. Your Honor, we're here because in 2001, this court issued a decision in the case of...
Can I get right to the point? What in Brenner, in Mr. Brenner's trade secret admission in the Warner-Lambert case, he admits the process is trade secret. What in that is found in your patented process? The one disconnect I couldn't find in your argument is what in the trade secret is admission applies to your patented process. Can you show me that?
Yes, the use of sodium bicarbonate in a depronation reaction to cause the change of sodium in allopurinol malate to become complete or almost complete enalapril sodium. So you change the enalapril malate to enalapril sodium in a reaction, in a wet granulation, that would be complete or almost complete. And Brenner refers to the process in his trial testimony on page A1616 of the joint appendix. This is from pages 155, and it runs through 161. And on 161, which is your page A1617, he is asked, Dr. Brenner, when Merck made its decision to maintain its process for stabilizing Vasutec and the role of sodium bicarbonate in that process, as a trade secret, was it aware that its package insert was publicly available at that time? He says, yes, it was. The package insert contained the ingredients. So Merck was well aware that even knowing the ingredients, that would not give you what the process was. Then, when Brenner gets very specific,
process are we talking about, if I could just interrupt for a second? The Vasutec process or the patented process?
The Vasutec process is what Brenner is talking about.
Right.
The Vasutec tablet was accused of infringing the Apotex process. That, the district court found that the Vasutec tablet was in fact produced by the infringing process, because the process made the enalapril malate in a wet granulation go to completion or almost complete. That, as Brenner says in the Warner-Lambert case, is a depronation process that he had never seen before.
Now, I'm looking at the claim one. Does that include the limitation of the completeness?
That is how Judge Cannelli interpreted it in the district court decision.
Can you point out where in the claim that
I can point it out in Judge Cannelli's original district court decision.
I'm looking at the claim.
The claim,
sure.
If I may, in the 780 patent, where the claim says a process of the manufacture of a pharmaceutically solid composition comprising enalapril sodium, which is the beginning sentence.
That's
so it's got
the preamble, okay.
The preamble, but it's telling us what the process has to result in. It says comprising enalapril sodium, which process comprises the steps of, and then it talks about, after the mixing, if we look down at B, about two-thirds of the way down, thereby to achieve a reaction without converting the enalapril malate to a clear solution of enalapril sodium. So you've got to create the pharmaceutically solid composition of enalapril sodium by converting the enalapril malate in a reaction without turning it to a clear solution.
Yeah,
And Judge Pennelly...
I have the same question that Judge Rader had. Where does that show the aspect that you're relying on?
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, in the claim interpretation, when the judge looked at this, he determined that that meant that the reaction had to go to completion or almost completion. That claim construction has never been appealed. It was never challenged. So we have to assume at this point in the proceedings that that is what that claim means. It was never appealed by Merck. They never challenged that claim interpretation. So that means that that claim requires the reaction to go to completion or almost completion. That would be the rule of law in this case. Brenner says, and I was pointing to his...
But let's just say that that's not a given. And let's look at the claim. And this is the critical point, I think. Where in the claim is that which was preserved wrongfully as a trade secret?
The reaction that causes the enalapril malleate to become enalapril sodium without it going into solution in a wet granulation.
But that's been disclosed.
Say again? I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That's not what you're relying on, is it?
That is what was not disclosed. That reaction, which has to go to completion, and again we go back to the claim interpretation that makes a completion. The court says, let's do it now. If this case had initially not been decided at summary judgment, and if it had gone to trial on the merits, then that would have been an issue to be decided whether that claim construction was correct. But that was never appealed. We have to assume that claim construction is correct.
It wasn't appealed because it wasn't an issue.
Oh, it was an issue because the question was, Merck said, we never suppressed our process for turning enalapril malleate into enalapril sodium. Nowhere in any of the published documents did they ever tell anyone that they were changing enalapril malleate into enalapril sodium.
You need to help me again. Where is Brenner admitting that we kept the patented process as a trade secret? When every place else they said it was fully and completely and openly disclosed.
And I know they said it, but they never did. And Brenner...
I think there's a disconnect between what Brenner is thinking is a trade secret and what you say is the patented process. That's what I'm suggesting.
Well, the first thing I'd like to do is, and in the deposition, I directed Brenner to page 8, little d, of Brenner 10, the supplemental expert report. And I have that page opened in front of me. It's page... it takes place in a couple places, but one of it is in 1907. And this is paragraph 6 of Brenner's expert report in the Warner-Lambert case. He says, I may also testify that even after we discovered at Merck that enalapril could be stabilized against cyclization by in situ deprotonation, and he uses the term deprotonation for the reaction that then changes enalapril malleate into enalapril sodium, because if you don't put in the right percentage of sodium bicarbonate, you're not going to get the conversion to enalapril sodium. That's the other thing. Just putting sodium bicarbonate in doesn't do it. You have to put the right amount in to cause that reaction to change it to enalapril sodium from enalapril malleate.
Now, which of your claims includes that?
Claim 1. Claim 1. It talks about...
Does it have a percentage?
In the specification, it describes the percentage, and the claim it says you make the conversion. I may also testify that even after we discovered at Merck that enalapril could be stabilized against cyclization by in situ deprotonation, there was a long and difficult period before we were able to consistently manufacture the enalapril formulation without stability problems. Through this process, we learned that numerous factors, including, for example, the type of mixing equipment, the duration and temperature of mixing, the holding time in the mixing equipment after mixing, and the particle size of sodium bicarbonate, moving on to A1908, all played an important role in the stabilization process.
But you see the problem, that none of that is in your claim.
We would suggest that by the claim covering the conversion in a wet granulation of enalapril malate to enalapril sodium, and having that conversion go substantially all the way or to be complete, whatever else they did to it besides the water to get it to go to that, is the trade secret. And that's what they did not show in Canada. Though they said they showed their process completely, they didn't.
Mr. Brushblatt, you were under 60B. So this material that we're now discussing also has to have been something you could not have discovered at the time. Why didn't you just ask them at the time the precise dimensions of what they had disclosed and what they had kept a trade secret? Back in the original 102G inquiry.
Two things, Your Honor, if I may. The first is, we are here under 60B independent action. Not as the district court said, 60B3. We've never said it's a 60B3 action. I don't know where Judge Cannelli got 60B3 from, but it shows up in about three or four places in his decision, and I think that guided his view and the granting of summary judgment. The independent cause of action under the
Hazel, so you're saying you didn't have to discover, you didn't have to make reasonable efforts to bring this dispute about what the was disclosed in the original Apotex trial, you didn't have to bring that up during the Apotex trial?
There was an inquiry made, Your Honor, and that was interrogatory 17. And the response was, we never suppressed or concealed it. So an inquiry was made.
What is it? That's back to the whole point of this thing. What is the it? And did you specify what is it that they had to disclose?
They were claiming that they had invented our process and they had under
and
102G
disclosed it.
Yes. The interrogatory said, what's your basis for your 102G defense? And they said, we never suppressed or concealed the
it.
We never suppressed or concealed the process because we showed it step by step in Canada. And the answer is, they didn't show it step by step in Canada. They left out what we learned when Brenner testifies and Warren Lever as being the key things. The other problem we have, and it really goes to the fraud on the court aspect, is this court...
Why didn't you find that out at the time?
I wasn't the attorney of record at the time.
Why didn't your client find it out?
I believe that they looked and did not, and were never told that the critical parts, as Brenner says in the supplemental report, were these five elements. That those were needed to cause the reaction to go to completion or almost completion. I believe that it was Merck who knew about the trade secret. They were the ones who understood they were keeping it. It was a decision made at upper level management. Why didn't Merck's counsel say in their brief to this court, oh yeah, we suppressed and concealed it to 1986, or in 1986 we made a decision to suppress and conceal it and keep it as a trade secret. That's what the Warner-Lambert panel in this court found. The Warner-Lambert panel in this court found, in January of 1986, Merck began selling it as Vasotec. Merck's decision was whether to seek patent protection for its process or to maintain it as a trade secret. It appeared at this point that all of the ingredients of Vasotec were in the public domain. However, Merck concluded that competitors would not be able to figure out the process for making Vasotec from its ingredients alone, namely the process used to stabilize enalapril against cyclization. That's the process to convert it from enalapril malate to enalapril sodium. Merck therefore chose to retain the sodium bicarbonate stabilization process as a trade secret in the Foucault patent protection. Juxtapose that determination by this court in Warner-Lambert at 418 Fed 3rd 1326 with this court's determination in the Apotex versus Merck decision at 254 Fed 3rd 1031. Our case law distinguishes between two types of suppression or concealment. The first is implicated in a situation in which an inventor actively suppresses or conceals his invention from the public. The second involves a legal inference of suppression or concealment based upon an unreasonable delay in filing a patent application. The later type is involved here. This court, on the one hand, says that there was no determination by an inventor to actively suppress or conceal his invention from the public. When you get Brenner's full testimony, this court determines something else. That Merck, in fact, did keep it as a trade secret, the same process.
Okay, we've exhausted your time, Mr. Bryce, but I'm afraid.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Resoukis.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honor. What we're dealing with here, as Judge Rader remarked, is a 60B action. What Apotex is bringing up is a number of facts that were available to it, not only available to it, but had actually discovered in the original case. Apotex had realized that they were not important to the determination the two courts arrived to in the original case. And now, having refiled its position, is trying to re-argue the same facts. A good example of this is when they opened with their appeal brief, they brought up the fact that they claimed there were these secret factors that Merck had withheld in the disclosure in Canada. These secret facts they claimed were necessary to have the reaction occur sufficiently to sufficient completion. We replied to that, and we showed at length in our red brief that they had actually questioned Dr. Brenner, no less, in detail about each of these factors. They came back in their reply brief, and what they tell us now is, well, what Merck hid was not the factors from us in the old case. What Merck hid was the fact that these factors were critical. And that's what they presented in their argument. That is still wrong. They deposed Dr. Brenner in November of 99. And they asked in detail again about these factors and the fact that these factors were important in having the reaction occur during this wet granulation process. In fact, what they asked him was, they asked him about the 3-to-1 molar ratio of sodium bicarbonate to an aliquot. And it's in the appendix in pages 2392 to 2393. He responded to them that the best reaction occurred when they had a 3-to-1 molar ratio. He talked about the role of hot water and the fact that the hot water was something that promoted the reaction. And that's in appendix page 2393. They addressed some memos that Merck had produced to them. Their memoranda that Merck had produced to them, that there were a number of factors that were studied for the effect they would have on the reaction extent. That appears in the appendix in page 2398. And all of these are questions that Apotex's lawyers actually had asked Dr. Brenner. And Dr. Brenner responded to it truthfully and in completeness. The problem that Apotex is facing here is that none of these factors were relevant to the inquiry the court had undertaken in the original case with respect to invalidity under Section 102G. This gets even further. They had questioned Dr. Brenner in the criticality of the particle size with respect to the reaction. And in appendix on page 2400, in particular, they read him from a memorandum that Merck had produced to them. And they asked him, Then you see Dr. Estain's statement. It says, it is imperative that particle sizes of both of these ingredients and the amount of water is extremely critical for the reaction to go to completion, and in turn has a profound effect on the chemical stability and the degradant levels in the Basotec tablets. And Dr. Brenner responded, from my own experience, I would concur that particle size was one of the elements. Not only in this case is there a case where the original courts reached the appropriate decision, because all of the aspects of the claimed invention were actually disclosed by Merck before the date of conception that Apotex had accepted. But in this case, they actually had all these additional facts that they're attempting to re-argue. And they were in their possession, and they decided not to bring them up, not to raise them. They didn't raise them because it really did not have an effect in their position. This is further demonstrated by the fact, In this case, when they brought the 60B action, we asked them in an interrogatory. We asked them, were you able to obtain relevant discovery with respect to these alleged secret factors? This was interrogatory number 6, and it's in the appendix in pages 2429 and 2430. They refused to respond. They said they would not answer because it was irrelevant. Then we asked them in interrogatory number 8, explain all relevant discovery that you were unable to receive in Apotex 1 in the original case. Again, they refused to respond. They said that that was irrelevant. The reason they refused to respond...
Did the trade secret aspect come out during that initial Apotex proceeding?
Absolutely. They had a 19... We produced...
Where's that in
the
record?
I'm sorry?
Where's that in the record?
Yeah, in the appendix in page 1714, we produced to them a document. It's a 1986 memorandum by a gentleman called Ryan, where he actually discussed the possibility that they would retain the existence of sodium bicarbonate in the formulation as a trade secret. That was in Apotex's possession. Our position in the original case was that the process that the claim that the applicant's invention under 102G was no longer by any concept suppressed or concealed as of March 28, 1994. If you recall the original case, we were moving for summary judgment, and in doing so, we wanted to remove any question of fact. So to the extent there were questions of fact as to what may have been occurring before March 28th of 1994, all our papers, and it's very clear, and I can go in painstaking detail through all our briefs, were all framed with our position as to what was the status of the applicant's invention after March 28th of 1994. And at the same time, it's important to recall that Dr. Sherman, the inventor for Apotex's patents, had conceded that there was no conception until 2 days after that. So we established that it was actually all the aspects of the claimed invention were available before the date of conception. Not only was that argued, in fact, that's reflected in the original decision of this court. Apotex, and this is this court's opinion on page 1040, Apotex argues that these disclosures, and this is referring to the disclosures that Merck was relying upon, inadequately described Merck's process of manufacturing vasopectaculase, and therefore that the public never received the benefit of the invention. They had all these facts. They knew exactly what was said in Canada and what we were relying upon as evidence that the process could not be disputably, could not have been concealed at the time, at any time, you know, as of March 28, 1994. Now, it's also important to keep in mind that in the Warner-Lambert case that they claim Dr. Brenner gave conflicting testimony, the critical date for the patent in that case was 1987. It was 7 years before the date that was relevant in the inquiry that was undertaken in Apotex 1. Now, with respect to the idea that this was actually perhaps actively suppressed or concealed, Apotex makes an argument that there is some difference in what they didn't know is that perhaps this was actively suppressed or concealed versus an inference of suppression and concealment. Well, as the document in the appendix 1714 shows, they had every reason to investigate that, and they actually could have claimed that there was active suppression and concealment. In fact, they did. And that is also reflected in this court's opinion in Apotex 1. If we go to page 1040 again, the original opinion of this court, it stated, moreover, Apotex's argument that Merck suppressed or concealed the process by submitting misleading information to the FDA in 1983 is irrelevant because any suppression that was implicated was overcome by Merck's subsequent activity. We therefore conclude that the district court did not err in granting summary judgment that the 780 and 962 patents are invalid under 102G.
Now, a key aspect seems to be the role of sodium bicarbonate in this. And indeed, on page 1617, we were shown an admission, or apparent admission, that Mr. Brenner says that was kept as a trade secret. Where was that either disclosed at the time of Apotex 1, or is that simply not part of the patent process? What's your argument on the sodium bicarbonate?
I think the role of the sodium bicarbonate was absolutely disclosed in the Canadian case. And the way that was established was through admissions that Apotex's inventor made. Once again, that's reflected on the record, and it's again reflected in the court's opinion, again on page 1040, where there are admissions that were made by the inventor, where he accepted the fact that once the ingredients were known, in other words, that once in the granulation you would mix an alkyl maleate, which any chemist would know is an acid, and you mix sodium bicarbonate, which is a base, and you added water to that, you would have an acid-base reaction. So the fact that there's a reaction was disputed, and in fact was very fiercely litigated in Apotex 1. And I think in the end, what carried the water was there were admissions by Dr. Sherman. There were admissions by other employees of Apotex that once you had those facts in your possession, and they were in the public's possession after March of 1994, the fact that there's a reaction was disclosed. And there was no question about that. One of the things I want to bring the focus back on is that this is indeed a Rule 60B independent action. And what Apotex needs to show is a very high standard. The cases, in fact, in these types of actions, show that there has to be a very grave miscarriage of justice, and that the actions that can result in that are actions such as bribery, falsified documents, and undue influence. In this case, Apotex has not only failed to show any of this, it cannot even allege any of these, it has failed to show, I believe, any misconduct on the part of Merck. If anything, Merck made every discovery available to Apotex, every avenue of argument was available to Apotex, and it was made. The case was hotly disputed, and it was fairly litigated, and Apotex lost. Now what we have is a rehashing of the old arguments, and they're coming back with new counsel and trying to present us with the same arguments they did before, in essence. You know, we can look, you know, at a couple of points. They try to point out that we made misleading statements. Our statements were not misleading. Our statements reflected the evidence that was in the case, and in fact, they reflected what had occurred. Apotex litigated against that and could not find any support for its positions. In fact, apart from admissions by their own inventor, that all of the aspects of the invention that were relevant had been disclosed by Merck before the March 1994 date. Apotex, again, also claims that Merck committed some misconduct by...
How do I know that this document on page 1714 was in the possession of Apotex during the first proceeding? This is the one that talks about keeping it as a trade secret. You told me that was clearly in Apotex's possession in the first proceeding. I hope if I understood you correctly.
Yeah, no, it was in their possession. In fact, it was produced here.
Probably some way I can tell that from looking at it, but I...
Yeah, if you were to look on the production numbers, and that's impossible, but it is a production number from the original case, and it was in their possession, I believe
where's the production number?
It is the MCK00558.
I got it.
And I believe that...
Your Honor, I'll stipulate.
They would not stipulate, but they would not dispute that.
One of thousands of documents provided to Apotex.
Thank you.
But Merck always took the position that with respect to a summary judgment motion, it could not be disputed that the process was no longer concealed after the March 1994 date, when Merck had made the disclosure of how the ingredients were mixed. Now, I will touch very briefly on the reverse engineering argument. And again, this is an argument, and as the district court recognized, that Merck absolutely made based upon admissions that were made by Apotex's inventor. If Apotex had wanted to dispute the logic of our conclusions based on his admissions, they could have done so in the original case. And in fact, they tried to, and again, they lost. And again, as I mentioned a little while ago, we feel there's no conflict between this decision and the Warren Lambert case, where the critical date that was in effect then was in 1987. Here we're talking about events that occurred in 1994, 7 years later. Simply put, we believe this is an attempt for a second bite at the apple by Apotex. Merck's conduct, if anything, was very open, providing all discovery that was requested of it, and perhaps beyond. And there is no reason to disturb the res judicata effect of the original case. If you have no questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bissett.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Prescott,
we exhausted your rebuttal time.
Yes, Your Honor. I may real quickly. I'd like to direct the court to A1714, the document that Mr. Barzoukas points to as in the thousands of documents. This was the one that alerted the free world that they were keeping it as a trade secret. I direct the court to the first paragraph. All it says is that the term other ingredients was used in this case to cover the sodium bicarbonate as a trade secret. It doesn't mention the process at all. And sodium bicarbonate, say again?
They don't deny that initially they kept it secret.
Oh, Brenner talks about, and what we've argued is, it was the process, which is in the patent, that they kept as a trade secret. Brenner says we kept it as a trade secret, the process, not the ingredient, because they knew, as this court found in the Warner-Lambert case, that the ingredients were out there in the public. Sodium bicarbonate, big deal. But it was its use in the process, because sodium bicarbonate is used to adjust pH normally in these formulations. Here it was used for the specific purpose of a depronation reaction, as Brenner sets out, and that was a trade secret. And that's what's covered in the patent, the use of sodium bicarbonate to convert an alkylmalonate. And I do want to point out one other thing. Murray, the attorney for Merck, who's on every one of the pleadings, was well aware that the Canadian process left out key aspects. And I asked him about it at his deposition. So where it says with the assistance of...
I think your time is exhausted.
All right, well, the court may look at that, and they admitted they left that out.
Thank you, Mr. Prescott. Mr. Bissett, this is taken into submission.